If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them. Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. I'm Kristen Roberts, Washington editor for the 30 news organizations all around America that together make McClatchy. Every week, we call reporters who live and work in political battleground states and ask them to tell us how voters are reacting to Donald Trump and Republican Washington, and what issues Americans outside the Beltway are thinking about that D.C. still is not. On the hook this week, Patty Mazzei of the Miami Herald, Chris Catalogo of the Sacramento Bee, Colin Campbell of the News and Observer in Raleigh, and of course, Alex Rorty, political correspondent here in D.C. Alex, what do you want to talk about this week?
I think this is a good time to focus on the Democratic Party, which, as everyone knows, is really eager to try to get back into power, not just in the 2018 midterms, but already looking ahead to the 2020 presidential election. And it's a party rife with division right now, whether we're talking about something like abortion, whether we're talking about a rural-urban divide, immigration, or even something like single payer. This is a party having really big debates about its future.
So I asked you to go off and find a Democrat who would be willing to talk about some of these divisions on some of these issues that are facing the party. Who'd you find?
Found a rising star. His name is Jason Kander. He was a Senate candidate last year in Missouri. And even though Hillary Clinton lost that state by nearly 20 points, he only lost it by a few points and really came out of that as someone who Democrats nationally, not just in Missouri, but nationally saw as an example of what the party can do to try to get back into power. He's running a voting rights group now and is someone people at least quietly talk about as maybe even a presidential contender in 2020.
All right, you ready to get this show going?
Let's do it.
January 20th, the day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
And our ideals and fundamental values are being attacked. Do we retreat or do we fight? I say we fight.
He heard those voices that were out there that other people weren't hearing, and he just earned a mandate.
It is time for Democrats to grow a backbone and get out there and fight.
The American people would like to try something new. We would like to see the country go in a different direction to change the course for America.
He doesn't take this presidency seriously enough.
So to all Americans, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Jason, thank you so much for joining us. And I know that we brought you on to talk a bit about the Democratic Party and the disagreements perhaps among the Democratic Party. But it's hard coming off of a weekend that we all just witnessed and not ask you something about that. And so you watched what all of America watched this weekend. And when you see that, when you see that violence, when you see the nuclear posturing on the part of this administration, when you see the threats of military action in South America, now an assassination plot potentially against a sitting U.S. senator, are you afraid of what comes next?
I think that all across America, this is unsettling and scary for folks. And it's not just because of the images on TV. It's also because the president had to be, pressured, cajoled. I mean, he didn't seem like someone who wanted to condemn this.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. 2 days ago, a young American woman, Heather Heyer, was tragically killed. Her death fills us with grief, and we send her family our thoughts, our prayers, and our love.
Yeah, I mean, the thing to remember here is that the President of the United States, whether you voted for him or not, I did not, but whether, no matter whether you support him or not, any of that, the President of the United States, by virtue of that role, is the cultural leader in the country. It's just part of being in that role. I mean, this is the person that every kid knows who they are. So what that means is that when something like this happens, the President of the United States usually speaks up not just to be politically correct. The President of the United States speaks up because people listen when the president talks. And so what I don't understand is, if you watch something like this and you watch people being violent out of hate, the KKK, Nazis on the streets in America, and you have the ability to speak up and maybe influence some of them, probably influence some of them, why would you need to be pressured to do that? I mean, you should want to do that with every fiber of your being. And what he's doing with this constant chaos and not stepping up and leading is cowardly. And it's also just not how you would lead anything, let alone a country. You couldn't lead a local club, a PTA, a Rotary, with the way that he's doing things.
Jason, it's an important question. Critics have charged that he has been reluctant to criticize these neo-Nazis because either he sympathizes with them or that they're part of his political base, and so he's worried what criticizing them could do to his own standing. Those are some very serious charges. Do you agree with either of them?
I think it's clear that one of those has to be the case. I can't think of any other reason, right? I mean, the CEO of Merck, who's an African-American, announced that he was going to resign from one of the president's commissions because the president was too slow to condemn this and hadn't at that point condemned it. And what, like within an hour, the president had condemned that guy on Twitter, had come out and said something nasty about him, but still took a whole bunch of time before he got around to, you know, condemning Nazis and the KKK. So there's no excuse here. And so either, I would certainly hope this isn't the case, but either the president does have some sympathies with these folks, or he's just afraid politically of them. And I'm sorry, like, I don't think it is too high a bar. I can't believe I have to say this. Too high a bar in American politics, that at the minimum, you should have the political courage, which it shouldn't take any at all, to take on the Nazis and the KKK. Like, if we have actually arrived at a point where we have a president who is politically afraid of coming out against Nazis and the KKK, then honestly, what good is it? He won't have the courage to do anything for this country if that's the case.
You know, Jason, I want to take a step back from Charlottesville and maybe talk about your own party right now. And of course, Democrats are unified in their opposition to Donald Trump, and they're really keen to try to win next year's congressional races and the midterm elections. And quietly, you know, I think the 2020 presidential race has already begun in some ways. But you do see, when you look at the Democratic Party, some division. I mean, just this month, there's been sort of an ongoing debate among a lot of the leaders in the Democratic Party about a so-called abortion litmus test and whether or not the party should welcome candidates who identify as pro-life or oppose abortion rights. You come from a place, a very conservative state in Missouri, where Hillary Clinton lost by almost 20 points last year. Now, you yourself did much better in a Senate race. But do you have concerns about what this debate means for the party, and that maybe everyone wants to have a big tent party, and that maybe that's becoming more difficult for Democrats?
When I hear about these divisions, it is most of the time by reading articles about it. And a lot of it, frankly, I think is coming from, there's debates of people in Washington, people in the higher echelons, I guess, of the party. But I've been, in the last few months, I've given speeches to Democrats in 18 states plus in D.C., and it is extremely rare that people bring up sort of divisions within the party or the different folks they look to at the national level. To me, what's really encouraging is that it's far more common that I meet people who got involved since January 20th of this year, and if there's a person who, you know, has drawn them into it, it's, for instance, somebody down the street from them who held a house party in order to get everybody in their neighborhood to call their members of Congress about the health care bill, or a local indivisible group, or in our case, Let America Vote, our organization. But that's the kind of stuff that's drawing people in, and that's really encouraging, because the most effective movements are the ones that start outside Washington and go to Washington.
Let me just jump in there. You know, it is a question that I think Democrats might have to answer now, though. In the case of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, you know, it came up whether or not they would support candidates, or their chairman said that they would not apply a quote-unquote litmus test to candidates and whether or not they were pro-life. I mean, that's something the Democratic Party has to figure out now. Should the party be welcoming to people who oppose abortion rights?
Sure. Well, look, I wouldn't personally support an anti-choice candidate because I feel so strongly about the issue. But it doesn't mean that those candidates and voters aren't welcome in our party, because they are. But my belief is that candidates need to authentically run on what they believe. So a pro-choice candidate should run that way, and an anti-choice candidate should run on what they believe. And from the party's perspective, I'm not sure about litmus tests, but certainly Democratic voters do have litmus tests. And I don't think there's many districts across the country where Democrats are going to nominate an anti-choice candidate, because most of the party and most Americans in general agree with us on this and agree with my view that this is a decision that is meant to be between a woman and her doctor and not a woman and a politician.
Let me just switch to another subject that has a very large debate in the Democratic Party right now, single-payer health care. And this was something that wasn't, it's fair to say, wasn't discussed in a mainstream kind of way until this year. Now you look at polls and a majority of Democrats support it. A lot of Democratic politicians, including yourself, I believe, voice support for some form of single-payer. Is there concern about the politics of this? Because you're talking about something that would just be an enormous piece of social legislation. I mean, the most significant entitlement legislation the country would have ever have had. And look, it's fair to say, I think it gives some Republicans ammunition to go after Democrats that they're going to replace your health care and the government's going to run health care. And some of the things that we've seen them say in the past now with maybe a little bit more amplified. Do you have any concern that this is a policy that could drag down the party politically?
Remember, my point of view on all of this is that you don't win arguments that you don't make. And look at what has happened here recently with the attempt to repeal Obamacare and put in Trump Care, which was deeply unpopular. It shouldn't be lost on everybody that folks around the country stood up and said, yeah, the odds are long of us stopping them from doing this with them controlling all the levers of power, but this is wrong and we're gonna be active and we're gonna stop it. And that's what happened. And it is because our side made our argument over the last several months. And I think that if we're being honest about what we believe that healthcare should be a right. And I happen to think the way to get there is single payer. And if somebody has a different way of doing that, then they just really need to make their argument authentically to the voters. And I think voters are going to reward them for that. So my bottom line here is we have to keep the momentum that we have going and we have to put it toward making healthcare a right in this country. I think it's time for that.
Well, Jason, hey, I want to thank you very much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Alex, that was an interesting interview. We touched on a lot of stuff in it. One thing that I want you to dig a little bit deeper into is this choice versus life debate that is actually a real thing in the Democratic Party right now.
Well, it's been going on for several months. It's dating back to something that the then new DNC chairman Tom Perez said about supporting candidates who opposed abortion rights. And it has continued into the summer. The chairman of the House Democrats political arm, the DCCC, Ben Ray Lujan, in an interview talked about how his committee won't apply, quote unquote, an abortion litmus test to its candidates. This drew a furious backlash from a lot of pro-choice groups. It was actually one of the rare stories, I think, that was bigger outside of Washington in some ways than inside Washington. There were stories in Vanity Fair and Cosmopolitan and other places about this. And there was just a concern. There's a lot of concern from pro-choice advocates and leaders that the Democratic Party, desperate to get back into power, is going to do so by casting aside abortion as an issue, and that they're going to recruit leaders and candidates who identify as pro-life, you know, and because there is some precedence for this. This is how the Democratic Party, as the legend holds it, won the 2006 House majority because Rahm Emanuel recruited a bunch of pro-life candidates. And so they're worried they're going to be thrown under the bus by the party when they argue that the politics of, in contemporary America anyway, favor candidates who identify as pro-choice and that the party needs to embrace this.
This is certainly Elise Hoag's perspective, yes.
Right. And she is the head of NARAL, which is maybe the most prominent abortion rights group going.
Let's listen to her here speaking on NPR.
If there was ever a stronger signal sent that women are looking for leadership who has our backs because equality and justice is more important in the Trump administration than it's ever been, that moment is now.
Alex, let's take this conversation over to North Carolina and talk with Colin Campbell about the rural-urban divide in the Democratic Party and the question of whether Democrats at the state level can bridge what is an ever-widening gap between Democratic voters who live in cities and those who do not.
Hey, Colin.
Awesome, as always, to be here.
Colin, I'm guessing you're hearing some of the same things I am. Some Democrats say we don't need those rural voters. We need to focus on the urban base. How much of a discussion is that in North Carolina right now?
Well, this is a particular challenge in North Carolina because the Democratic Party here for many, many decades had a big stronghold in some of the rural parts of the state. But as the state has grown more urban, there's been a population influx to cities like Raleigh and Charlotte. The Democratic Party has tended to go more liberal in those areas. places where people are more concerned about some of the social issues, certainly within the last couple of years because of the bathroom bill and other things. LGBT rights have become a big issue for the Democrats in North Carolina. And all of that has served to, I think, alienate some of the more conservative rural Democrats. We've seen a loss of some of the rural moderate to conservative Democrats in the legislature. There used to be a lot of them. Now they're down to just a handful. I could probably count the folks in that category on one hand out of our 170-member state legislature. And the challenge for the party is, how do you have essentially two messages? Well, you want to keep your base going in the urban areas, and you can't ignore things like LGBT issues in those areas. But in the urban areas, those messages haven't been resonating. And so how do you go about crafting a message that can win those people back over so that they're not voting Republican? And that's the big challenge for the party here. I actually sat down recently with the state party chairman, Wayne Goodwin, who is a former state insurance commissioner and actually grew up in the small town of Hamlet, North Carolina. And he explained to me a little bit about what the party is looking to do to try to fix this problem here in North Carolina.
Rural communities are eager and just hungry to hear which party will truly carry out what they've purported to be stand for. You know, growing up in, you know, in, again, rural North Carolina, what really resonates most for families there and communities is that how much will be invested in what's proven to help lift communities and families, and that is a stronger public school system, improved infrastructure, maintaining and building on the healthcare infrastructure. So you have hospitals and doctors and clinics so that families can get the care they need. Basically, kitchen table issues that families deal with every day. So that's what Democrats, I believe, can and must do to reconnect with rural citizens, and that is to focus on the things that unite us and not the wedge issues that not only can split up folks in one party, but can split up folks in both major political parties.
Goodwin really does want to make a push for the rural areas, but a lot of people are sort of looking very pragmatically at the demographics. The rural areas in North Carolina are shrinking. The population is going down, while the population is going up pretty dramatically in places like Raleigh and Charlotte. And so the sense among some Democrats is that they can just kind of wait it out, and eventually you perhaps might not need the rural areas because the urban areas will be so disproportionately heavy with population that if you can get the base turned out in good enough numbers there, you might be okay.
You know, it's interesting. There was a study done after the election by Real Clear Politics that found, you know, if you really wanted to boil down why Hillary Clinton lost, you have to look at the her loss of the vote in rural areas and small towns. You know, she was able to make some gains in medium-sized cities or large cities, really, but they weren't enough to compensate for the loss here. And, you know, this is a big problem for the Democratic Party because you can drive up the vote. And in fact, you can, in a place like North Carolina, maybe demographics are destiny. And eventually the Democratic Party can win that state consistently, just driving up the vote in its urban base. But look, there are a lot of states and a lot of congressional districts, in fact, where that's not the case. And so, look, maybe the Democratic Party can do this and they can win the presidency. But Congress is going to be another matter, especially in the Senate. There are just too many rural agrarian states for the party to have any shot of being able to hold a Senate majority or even a House majority and only focusing on these urban centers.
Yeah, you have to remember that Republicans control so many state legislatures that they get to, at least for now, draw the district lines, and they're drawing the lines in a way to help Republican-centered districts. So in order to take back Congress, Democrats have to have a message that can perhaps flip some of those districts that would otherwise naturally go Republican.
So listen, guys, you know, it's impossible to not see race here. We're talking about rural and urban, but are we not really talking about black and white?
Mostly. That's absolutely what almost all of this is.
You know, we're coming off of a weekend where neo-Nazis rallied in Charlottesville, a rally that sparked incredible violence that we all watched on television and that many of us wrote about. I do wonder what the reaction is, both, you know, the Republican reaction. Is this the opportunity where they distance themselves from a president who really seemed reluctant to explicitly condemn the white nationalists and white supremacists who held this rally, but also how the Democrats react in this moment? And when we're talking about urban versus rural divide or black versus white divide in the Democratic Party, are we getting ourselves to a place where the Democratic Party becomes simply a party for the people of color in America?
It's been interesting here in North Carolina to see the difference in reactions. I haven't seen the level of tepid response from the president echoed in any of the statements from politicians here. The Republican Speaker of the House here had a fairly strong statement condemning white supremacy specifically. The state GOP Executive Director Dallas Woodhouse actually had a statement saying the person behind the car attack in Charlottesville should face a swift trial and execution, which I think may have been a reference to the death penalty. So certainly a lot of people are not following Trump's lead on taking a very tepid response to the Charlottesville activities.
We should point out Dallas Woodhouse is not a politically correct figure.
Yeah, he kind of shoots off, but I saw similar strong messages from Republicans in this state, which I was a little bit surprised by. I thought more people might sort of take the same approach as the president of trying to blame all sides for the level of violence we saw in Virginia.
Colin, thank you so much for dialing in. It was really good to talk with you again.
Great to chat with you as always, Kristen.
Alex, let's shift to healthcare, which is another one of those critically important, almost foundational issues for Democrats. And let's go out to Chris Catalago at the Sacramento Bee for the latest in California. Chris, how you doing out there?
It's great to be back talking about California Democrats.
All the time, man. I want to talk about the one big issue that's really dividing a state that is about as blue as it comes, and that's healthcare and the question of single-payer healthcare. Tell us, Chris, where is this storyline in California right now, and why is it that Democrats with a supermajority in the legislature couldn't push forward an issue that is kind of core to its progressive base?
This is really core. If you look at the Democratic Party platform in California, you see strong support for the single-payer issue. But what we saw this year in the legislature was kind of where the rubber hits the road in terms of crafting legislation that would work. And Democrats in the legislature passed this, got it through the state Senate, and then it was held in the assembly. And part of the reason was they just didn't find a way to pay for it.
This issue is something that has been talked about in California for years. And I feel like after the 2016 presidential, a lot of people were looking to California as, you know, the home of the left. And there was a lot of built up anticipation about this debate this year.
We don't get no help.
That was the feeling nationally. Did it feel like a missed opportunity when it didn't happen for Democrats out there this year?
The big supporters of this bill, and that would be the nurses union, kind of see this as a little bit of a double-edged sword. This is further than they've gotten in quite some time. And so they have real reason to celebrate. They push this issue to the forefront. Now, on the flip side, they obviously wanted it to get further. We have candidates in the governor's race. We have candidates in congressional races who have set this issue up as a litmus test. So I don't think you're seeing people look at it as a big a setback as people outside the state might be. Obviously, there's a lot of hard feelings over how the bill was shelved. There's even sort of a recall attempt of the Democratic Assembly Speaker down in his district that may or may not go anywhere. So there are some hard feelings over it, but I think there has been a commitment on the part of a lot of Democrats to at least take this issue up. It's a two-year legislative session. So we're not seeing the last of a single payer in California.
You recently spoke with Don Nielsen. What did he have to say about where the Nurses Association goes from here on this issue?
They're going to continue to push. And as he said, you know, there's some anger about the speaker, but they're not backing down. When I spoke to him from Fresno, he was thinking of different ways where they could get this back in front of the legislature.
There's still plenty of time to move this. You know, things can happen when there's political will. And we've seen that recently with all sorts of other items, cap and trade, gasoline tax, last year, $15 minimum wage, you know, it goes on and on, right? When there's political will, then amazing things can happen, and they can happen in very short periods of time. Many Democrats, not necessarily all of them, but many of them are having a hard time deciding where their loyalty lies. You know, are they, in fact, on the side of the people and as progressive as many of them claim to be, or are they on the side of the corporations and Wall Street that don't want to see this happen? You know, it's a real moment of clarification. You know, people are having to stand up and be counted. And, you know, we will never back down. This is too important an issue.
I think one of the interesting things when I think about California and this issue is the idea that it is such a blue state. There are so many Democrats in that legislature, but that's a really superficial metric because it masks a number of divisions within the Democratic Party itself. And I think it's surprising to many people outside of California exactly how many conservative voters there are in the state. And so while it might be surprising to some that they couldn't push single payer forward in this anti-Trump environment in California right now, it's not surprising when you realize that it's not a solid wall of progressive activism, even though it might feel that way outside, no?
No, Democrats are not a monolith in California. We see the same sort of insider-outsider debate that we're seeing at the national level here. We see people who get up and talk about all the ideals that they'd like to see implemented in government. And when you're elected and when you're in office, you deal with sort of all the same sorts of nuts and bolts that you have to get done in order to move legislation. One of the big factors in California that I think people don't talk about enough is while we have a whole bunch of progressive elected leaders, and California is seen as very progressive on the scale in terms of the country, we have a governor in Jerry Brown who is not universally sort of willing to spend in every possible way. He came into office with a pretty big budget hole during the recession. And I think he has been seeing himself as sort of a backstop on a lot of the largest progressive ambitions. And I think we have to factor him in when we talk about why the state may not be adopting free college and every other liberal talking point that we're seeing at the national level.
Do you think that the anger over this bill's failure is going to lead to serious primary challenges in California?
I think there's some possibility. I think for Democrats in the congressional races, they're already, especially in the Republican seats where they're trying to take folks out, we're already seeing some splintering. Today, the National Nurses Union just very recently actually endorsed Doug Applegate, who is taking on Daryl Issa. That's become an issue. He's come out for Medicare for All. We're seeing it play in some congressional races. The head of the National Nurses Union has said that it's a possibility that we will see some primaries. I think it just depends on how committed folks are to doing this, and people kind of go off on their own. We have all kinds of separate splinter groups in the state. It's not all the nurses. It's every district has its own progressive group, and we're seeing a lot of grassroots activism that's cropping up, and it's just really hard to predict where it will go. You know, what you do get is sort of a backlash if people do come out and say, I'm strongly for this, and then they take office and they're in a position to do something about it. That's where you really see the backlash from the left, where people are talking one way when they're campaigning and then not following through when they're in office. And I think we still have to go through a cycle or two before that happens.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us again.
Anytime. Thank you.
Everybody should forgive the pun, but another one of those stealthy issues that riles Democrats is national security. For decades, it has dogged them. Let's bring in Patty Mazzei, who's been working day and night on one of those foreign policy crises that is involving Washington at this very moment, and that is Venezuela. Patty, how are you?
Hey, Kristen, I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, but you haven't gotten any sleep in some days now, have you?
I don't know what day it is or what hour it is, but let's just roll.
You know, Venezuela seems like an opportunity for Democrats to stake out a different position on foreign policy than the White House, but it feels like they've been entirely absent from this conversation.
They are silent. I mean, I think the only ones I've heard talk about it are folks in South Florida, because there's a huge Venezuelan community down here. And so we're talking about Senator Bill Nelson, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but you know, Nelson is supportive of further sanctions against Venezuela, economic sanctions, perhaps against the oil industry. These are the kind of sanctions that Republicans like Marco Rubio have been pushing, although Rubio isn't really pushing for an oil sanction, but yes, a broader economic penalty. So it's really difficult for Democrats to stake out a position here. You would think that they would see some divisions within the Republicans. For example, you have Gulf Coast state senators telling the president, please don't hit the Venezuelan oil industry because you might hurt our states, right? Louisiana, Texas being two of the key examples. And instead, Democrats are just kind of nowhere to be found on this.
You know, this is part of a bigger challenge for Democrats, whether it's Latin America, Middle East, or really anywhere else when it comes to foreign policy. It's just not something they want to engage on because it's not something that unites the Democratic Party right now. Hey, look, there's a reason we've talked in recent weeks about the so-called better deal agenda. The Democratic leadership in Congress wants to talk about the economy because they think the party can come together on the economy. Well, when it comes to foreign policy, a lot of times they have anything but unity. You have a lot of long-time establishment Democratic figures who worry about, you know, this old notion that the Democratic Party is soft on foreign policy, whether it's soft on terrorism or they were soft on communism decades ago. And they're worried about the electoral fallout from that in any foreign policy context right now. You know, but there is a different wing of the Democratic Party, and I think it's fair to say it's more liberal. It's also younger. You know, for them, a sort of formative event of their probably political identity was the Iraq War. And that's where you saw this division, maybe worst of all. You know, they saw a party that they don't think did enough to oppose the Iraq War. And obviously, from their point of view, there were huge fallout from that. But also there was a political fallout. They felt like the Democratic Party got cowed into supporting this war. And if they hadn't, they would have been on much firmer footing and say like the 2004 presidential election. And so they just, you know, they don't see any reason to back down on this. And it could be a huge divide in the party.
When we talk about foreign policy and the Democrats' difficulty in staking out a consistent policy position on some of these big issues, the thing that strikes me as incredibly noteworthy is the absence of the old bulls. I mean, there used to be real foreign policy heavyweights in the Democratic Party. And I'm thinking about Joe Lieberman and Joe Biden and Levin and Kerry. And, you know, where are Democrats now? The voices in Congress on foreign policy are Republican. It's Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul and John McCain.
Bob Menendez. You know,
Bob Menendez is one really great example that I heard Patty just utter from, you know, some 100 miles away from us. But he's one man.
Right. And he's aligned with Rubio, certainly on Latin America. And so when you have Menendez and Nelson, who is up for re-election next year and considered vulnerable, aligned with the Republicans, there really is no internal party debate. And to Alex's point, it is easier to be opposed to a conflict, you know, whether existing or being debated, right? It is easy to oppose intervention. But in this case, at least on the Venezuela matter in particular, no one is really clamoring for intervention. So when you don't have a political position to stake out against something, what are you for? And I hate going to those stereotypes of the mommy and daddy party, right? But if you don't want to talk about foreign policy at a time when polls show that people are really concerned about some of these big threats from abroad, then you can't just talk about healthcare and education all the time.
One issue I just want to bring up because I think it's going to be huge in 2020, Israel. Young Democrats especially are very vocal in their questioning of whether or not the party or the country should be as supportive of Israel as it traditionally has been for the entirety of Israel's existence. And look, this is not something that is new necessarily, but if you pay attention to the platform fights at the DNC, to be honest, I know none of you have, but that's my job. That's what I do.
I have.
you will have seen it in 2012 and some accusations of the sort of Democratic Party establishment just rolling over objections to the part of their platform talking about the defense of Israel. You know, this is something that is going to really be a huge story in 2020. And I'll tell you, look, it's early, but it wouldn't surprise me if one or even several of the major Democratic candidates for president in 2020 somehow distanced themselves from Israel or would not offer the kind of support, you know, that even someone like President Obama, who certainly took a share of criticism on Israel, the kind of things that he wouldn't even commit to, that's going to be a huge issue in 2020.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because, as you know, we have this 7-person Democratic primary down here for Florida's 27th congressional district. That is the Democratic-leaning district currently held by Republican Ileana Ross-Layton, and we expect an 8th Democrat to get in. And one of the questions I always ask these new candidates is, in what area do you disagree with the Democratic Party? Because Ross-Layton is known for her disagreements with the Republican Party, and voters here seem to like someone with some independence. And a couple of them have said, I disagree with them on Israel in that they are more hawkish on Israel, which is more of a Ross-Layton in position. I mean, we have a large Jewish American population in that district. It includes Miami Beach. But I think that goes to your point, Alex, that they've detected that this is changing a little bit in the Democratic Party, and they're trying to make sure that voters know that they have not changed with it.
That's a really good point, Alex. I foresee many story assignments in your future.
I'm ready.
Patty, thank you for joining us after not sleeping for 14 days. I hope you
get a
break, but I know who your editor is, and so I bet you will not.
That's all right. We roll with the news when it's crazy, and that is where it is right now.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you to our guest, Jason Kander, and thank you to the panelists, Alex Rorty, Patty Mazzei, Colin Campbell, and Chris Catalago. And of course, thank you to our executive producer, Davin Coburn. But perhaps most importantly, thank you to our listeners. We want to hear from you. So please send your questions and your comments to btb@mcclatchy.com. Tell us what you're seeing in your battleground state. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. Leave us a review and tell us what you think. Talk to you next week. In fact, for decades, it has dogged them. Dogged. I can't say that word without my New Jersey accent. I'm going to try it again. All right, let's jump to Colin. Colin, hello. Actually, you say hey, Colin.
Okay.
Hey, Colin.
Hey, Colin. Okay. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Colin.
Yo, Colin.
Hey, Colin. And then Alex answered some way really smart.
And it couldn't be made up by the votes she gained in large cities. You know, and there's a... Sorry, guys, I got way off. I hope that dog line is in the blooper reel. The New Jersey accent.
You don't curse, but you do sigh in a really aggressive way.
Some aggressive sigh. That's in lieu of cursing.
Yes, so, okay.
You want me to go get you some coffee after this? I would just... try to piece this together.
Oh, my God.
The moment we leave this room, there's going to be some aggressive sighing.
Seriously.
Some aggressive
sighing. Aggressive sighing.
And no one will blame you.